You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Welcome to Heritage Voices, episode 67. I'm Jessica Uquinto, and I'm your host. And today we are talking about Makuns Tamakwa, early career archaeological contracting. Before we begin, I'd like to honor and acknowledge that the lands I'm recording on today are part of the Nooch, or Ute People's Treaty Lands, the Dineta, and the ancestral Puebloan homeland. Today we have Anastasia Walhoved on the show. Anastasia is an enrolled member of the Red Cliff Band of Ojibwe and descendant of the White Earth Band of Ojibwe, as well as an archaeologist. She received her degree in anthropology / archaeology from Harvard College in 2013 and will start her master's degree at New Mexico State University in fall 2022. Anastasia runs Makuns Consulting, LLC, an archaeological contracting company, and she is the founder of the Tribal Archaeology Network. So welcome to the show, Anastasia.
Oh, thank you. Bujou, Miigwech. Thanks for having me. I'm very excited to be here.
Yes. So, okay. We mentioned Anastasia a couple of episodes ago on the Indigenous-led CRM businesses episode, and we had been hoping to have her join us on that episode. Like the boss lady that she is, she had to be in the field. So getting work done. So we have her here today instead. But for everyone that is interested in Indigenous-led CRM and heritage firms, definitely go back and listen to that episode and then come back to this one and hear more about one specific person's story after hearing about all of the different journeys from that episode. So really excited to have you because like we talked about before we came on air, the way that you've done things is a little different than anyone else. So I think it'll be a really interesting story for our listeners who are interested in the CRM route and not quite sure which direction they want to go in. So excited to have you.
Thank you for having me. I'm very excited to be here. I think, you know, a lot of the people who are in the other episode are kind of a little bit later in their career, a little bit more advanced. And I'm definitely not. I'm definitely a newbie, but I have done things a little bit differently. I think, especially if you're like a student or you're just starting out, I think it's really good to hear from someone who's maybe at this point where I'm at in my career, kind of get a feel for it and, you know, see what other directions you can go. So I'm very excited and I feel very honored to be on the podcast. So Chief Miigwech, thanks very much for having me on here.
Yeah. And, you know, I don't think that you were the most recently started company for that episode. I think there was one of the companies has started more recently than you did. So you're not, maybe not as much a newbie as you think. Yeah.
Maybe not.
But anyway, to get us started, first, what got you into this field? What got you excited and interested in this kind of work?
So when I was a kid, you know, you would always ask, you know, you always ask kids what they wanted to do when they grew up. And well, I had a couple of things over the years, but archaeology was something that I always was really, really interested in. I always thought it was very, very cool. I wanted to be an archaeologist. And, you know, my mom always had a subscription to National Geographic. And so I would read those from cover to cover. I thought they were so cool. And my mom really encouraged us to go to travel and see new things. And I was just kind of really, really interested in the concept of archaeology. So I think that's how I originally got into it, just as a kid. And then as I got older and started applying for school, I specifically only applied to schools that had archaeology programs. And then I remember getting into school and kind of like learning more about archaeology and like understanding like what it meant as an Indigenous person to do archaeology. And that was like the first time that I was like, oh no, what have I done? I was like, oh no, am I the colonizer? And I was very, you know, it's like an existential crisis. And I think if you talk to a lot of Indigenous archaeologists, a lot of them go through that. The crisis of like, you know, the history of archaeology is very much so a history of colonization. And it's so closely tied with it and it's been used as a tool of colonization. But I think sort of, I kind of had that little crisis and after college, I was sort of dealt with it and I worked in other fields for quite a while. Actually, I worked in natural resources for a little bit. I worked in legal administration you know, I worked in like restaurants, I bartended, I did all of these odd things. I've been told that I'm the queen of side jobs to try and figure out. And I just kept coming back to wanting to do archaeology. And I finally kind of, you know, accepted, like, you know, I'm going to have to use this really as a tool to benefit Indigenous communities and benefit descendant communities. And just like find the way to do that. And so that's kind of what's brought me back into it and feeling good about being an archaeologist and being an Indigenous person as well, is trying to essentially transform this field into being something that can be a force for good. That's a long-winded answer.
No, trust me. There have been people that have answered and it's taken up the entire segment. So that was actually pretty quick. So when you were in college and you were first learning about archaeology and you're learning about it for the first time in an academic setting and you're, mm-hmm. you know, going through all of these things, trying to figure out, you know, what relationship you'd want to have with archaeology and its colonial background and stuff like that. Did you have any exposure to Indigenous archaeology at that point? Like, had you heard about any of that while you were in college, or was that something that you only came to later?
That was something that I learned more about while in college and kind of probably after college more so too. So I, you know, I remember asking around as a kid about like who knew anything about archaeology, and like no one seemed to know anything about archaeology. It was kind of like, you know, it's like telling people that like you want to go to the moon or something like that. Like, who becomes an archaeologist? Isn't that something that's in the movies?
Mm-hmm.
My parents, they worked for the Bureau of Indian Affairs for a long time. And so they knew that archaeology was like a real thing with a real job. But they, not that they themselves knew all that much about it, but they knew that, you know, the BIA had archaeologists and they knew that they did some sort of survey work. And so I think a lot of people, when you tell your parents you want to be an archaeologist, it's like telling them, I want to be a starving poet, you know, or a starving artist. And so but to my parents, they were like, oh, no, like you can do that. That's like a real thing people do. We don't know that much about it, but we know that like you can actually have a job and be paid to do it. So they were encouraging of me doing archaeology, but like, the, you know, we didn't know anything about Indigenous archaeology, nothing along those lines. And I'm not sure at what point my tribe got a TIPO or a tribal historic preservation officer. I'm not sure. But at the time, I don't know if my parents knew who it was or anything like that. They didn't really think of putting me in contact with them. I was still really new. I didn't even really know that much about it. And then when I was in my junior year of college, I got an internship. We called it like the summer youth crew. And I was the summer youth crew leader, which meant I was in charge of, they had high school students that they were trying to introduce to careers in natural resources. And I was in charge of these students. There was two or three of them at a time, generally, that I was in charge of. And we would go and shadow all these different professionals in natural resources. And I'm not sure how I finagled myself into that job, you know. Well, natural resources and archaeological resources survey are closely tied, you know, and you often have to do them for to meet federal and state regulation and that sort of stuff. And although I think I'd be a good fit for this position. And they ended up hiring me. And it was actually during that time that we got to shadow. I shadowed a gentleman who was an archaeologist for the BIA, and he himself was Indigenous. It was just kind of like, it was a great time just walking around with him. We didn't do very much. I think we only maybe spent an hour or two with that man. But I was like, oh, wow. I was like, this is real. That was like my first real experience, I think, with someone who is an Indigenous archaeologist. Yeah. And then I got to meet the TIPO as well as I was doing that job. And for a while I was in the same building as him. So we were very close offices, very close desks and that sort of stuff. And he was kind of telling me a little bit more about, you know, what he did what he did. He's no longer with us, and, you know, what he thought of archaeology itself, and shared some of the, you know, he had a lot of reservations actually about archaeology. He was quite suspicious of archaeology. and in like why he was a little bit hesitant a lot with working with archaeologists, which makes a lot of sense. So I was kind of, I learned a little bit from him. And that's when I was starting to get, I think I got a little too cautious. And I was like, let's try some other things in my career. But I kept coming back to archaeology, and I threw caution to the wind and said, you know what, I think I'm smart enough and I have enough skills having done all these other things that I think I can do this in a good way. And I just got to keep talking to other people, elders and people in my community, and checking in with myself to make sure that I feel that this work is being done in a good way and it's going to be benefiting the community rather than harming it. So, gosh, what was the original question now?
Oh, so the original question, but it's funny because you actually answered some other questions that I was going to ask next. So it's perfect. I was just asking about when you were in college, whether you had seen any examples of archaeology done in a way that you would want to do it. Obviously, you saw a lot of examples in the history of what you wouldn't want to do in archaeology. Mm-hmm. But just like, what was that?
Yeah.
Something that you were exposed to at that point, or was that more of a later finding examples on your own sort of a situation?
Yeah, I think that's was more of a later finding. I think I still think that I'm learning a lot about what I think I want it to look like too. You know, I'm always learning this. It's like, okay, we want to do this. We want to, you know, add this into the practice. So I feel like it's always evolving. It's not like I have this, there's like a concrete stone and I chisel in the directions on like how to be the best indigenous archaeologist. That doesn't exist. I think the best way to be, I think, being an indigenous archaeologist is recognize that this is a very sort of novel concept in a lot of ways. And in the field, you know, a lot of people like the idea of indigenous archaeology, but they don't know what it means. And to me, I feel like indigenous archaeology is such an intimate thing, I think, for like not just an individual person, but also like within a tribe. And so one tipo might see it a little bit differently than another tipo. And I think a lot of it is about respecting and working with and listening to specifically the communities you're going to be most directly impacting with your work, or that are like most directly interested or related to whatever it is, the site or whatever it is, the work that you're doing. And working with them, you know, there's no perfect formula of like, yes, and this will be the perfect project in which you include Native voices. Like, that doesn't really exist. It's all about like learning to get a lot of feedback from people and finding the best way to incorporate all of it, being flexible. Yeah. So the answer is I'm still learning.
Aren't we all? I mean, I think,
yeah.
Yeah. If you're not, then that's when you get in trouble, right?
Exactly.
Okay. So you stepped away for a little while and you were doing the other things that you mentioned. And you know, it sounds like doing some of this research on your own, looking into options or ways of doing it or thinking about it. What did the journey back look like?
The journey back
to archaeology.
In 2018, I was working in legal administration, and I had originally gotten into legal administration because I was thinking, oh, maybe I want to be a lawyer. I very quickly learned I did not want to be a lawyer, but I was doing that for a little bit just to have steady income and et cetera. And I was just very, very unhappy with it. You know, I'm now that I've spent a lot of time playing in the dirt, I know that I'm supposed to go like play in the dirt for part of the year. I'm supposed to be out in the sun and that sort of stuff. I started volunteering for the Minnesota Historical Society. I got a little message from their volunteer coordinator, and she said, you know, I read over your resume and I see you have a degree in archaeology. She says, we have this volunteer position and we don't normally advertise it because it's generally full. She says, but there is an opening. We just haven't advertised it. Would you be interested in helping to catalog artifacts? And I say, oh, yeah, sure. So that's how I started, I guess, back into it. I was cataloging artifacts for the Minnesota Historical Society with quite a number of people who seems like they had been doing it for a long time. That's where I met Pat Emerson. And Pat Emerson was an archaeologist for the Minnesota Historical Society and kind of like a giant in Minnesota archaeology. She was very encouraging for me to learn more and get more experience. And at that point, I had very, very little experience doing archaeology in my own homeland. Almost all my archaeology had experience had been, you know, like my field school and like out east in Massachusetts and in Peru. And I hadn't done anything in Minnesota or Wisconsin. So she was very helpful and very encouraging for me as I was trying to get back into this. So I got invited to the, they have Archaeology Month hosted by the Minnesota Historical Society in the month of September. And they do a number of different events there. And they had this event. It was like a number of different archaeologists from around the state. And I think you could like, you know, fling an atlatl and, you know, you could learn about underwater archaeology in Minnesota. And I think there was like a couple of cool collections that they put out on display. And, you know, that was out at Fort Snelling. And I went to that and I was having a conversation with the underwater archaeologist there. Lovely couple that runs a nonprofit underwater archaeology business in Minnesota. And I had a long conversation with them and I was like, oh, I'd love to volunteer for you guys. I was like, I'd love to put on some scuba gear and like do some of this work. And that ended up being logistically a little challenging to do, but they put me in touch with Jeremy Nino of Nino Cultural Consultant. And Jeremy Nino, I later learned, was actually the one running the atlatl stand. I just hadn't met him. Anyways, I reached out to him and I said, you know, I'm actually looking to do work in this field, not just volunteer. I had been volunteering for, he said, you know, I've been looking for archaeological texts. He's like, I don't actually have any employees because I don't know, at least like, I don't have enough work to keep them year round, that sort of stuff. He's like, I only really know how to, he's like, I just have contractors. So it's like all he was able to do at that point with the amount of work he had was he had contractors. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he must have listened in on my conversation with the underwater. So thought I was very intelligent, but we got to know each other a little more. And he said, you know, I would love to have you on for the season, but you just have to start your own LLC. And to me, that was like, you know, it's kind of like, this sounds too good to be true. Or, you know, that's like a big commitment too, I think, to think of like, I'm going to start my own business. Like, shouldn't I be an employee first and like work my way up? And but that's what I ended up doing. I decided, I had asked around to a couple other archaeologists and they had been doing that for quite a while and they were making, you know, good money doing it and they liked their freedom and it was really working well for them. And I decided, you know, why the heck not? So I started at Macoons Consulting, and Macoons is an Ojibwe word that means bear cub. And because I do feel a little bit like a baby bear cub in archaeology, I hope someday to be Mukwa Consulting, which is bear, not just bear cub consulting, but we're starting with Macoons. Maybe once I finish my master's degree, I'll switch to Mukwa Consulting. But so yeah, I started up Macoons Consulting and I started doing work. And that was a big game changer for me because I got an enormous amount of experience doing a lot of different things very shortly.
Cool. All right. So we are already at our first break, but obviously I want to hear more about all of that when we come back. So we'll be right back. All right. Okay. We're back. And you were just telling me about getting the recommendation to start your own LLC. And I was telling you off air that my story was kind of similar in some way. So you started this LLC and then what?
Yeah. So I started this LLC and I started doing work in the field and I was working with a number of archaeologists who were all contractors. We all had, you know, our own LLC. And
this was all for that guy that you met at the event that you went to.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Okay.
You know, I had like done some Googling. It wasn't like I just, you know, I had asked around about him a little bit. Anyways, yeah. I remember I actually specifically asked Pat Emerson about it. She was like, oh, no, you should definitely do it. And I think that was kind of where I was like, oh, okay. Pat Emerson thinks this is a good idea. Then I will look into this. So I got my LLC. I started up. I started going to the field with everybody, and it was kind of a small group. I think there was like maybe five or six of us who were all archaeological contractors with our own LLC working, or subcontractors, I should say, underneath the larger contractor. And it was such a small sort of team, and it was a very large project. And we were doing a phase two for an absolutely enormous area on a very big historic site that had a prehistoric component in it as well. So there was a lot going on. And so it was kind of an all hands on deck situation. And I have to give a lot of credit for my success to these people that I've worked with, because they were really showed me the ropes for a lot of things in CRM. And, you know, I had, you know, you get experience in field school digging, but it's very different once you get into CRM and to actually get out there and try and get things done, you know, on time and before it rains and before the thunderstorm and for the client and all these things. And, you know, they were with all the things that come into completing what we call a phase two, which is sort of an evaluation and assessment of an archaeological site within Minnesota. We call that phase two. It was, we would do the field work and then we come back to the field and they'd say, oh gosh, we really need someone to photograph all this because our normal photography guys got to go do this. And so they'd say, oh, Anastasia, you want to like give it a shot? And I was like, all right. And so then I learned how to do archaeological photography that day. And then you learn how to do cataloging in the Getty Art and Architecture Thesaurus. And, you know, you like, I kind of got this really whirlwind training and how to do a lot of different aspects of CRM, of cultural resource management, archaeology that you wouldn't maybe normally get for a lot of techs in their first year, or maybe even a couple of years. A lot of people don't learn how to, they only learn one aspect of it. They learn about the lab, they learn about the field, but not the other. So I was kind of thrown into this world and I like learned a little bit of everything right away. And I think that's, I attribute a lot of my success to those people who sort of guided me through that and encouraged me to keep learning new skills, So that's how I got, I guess, to where I am now.
And then like, you know, when that ended, did you work on projects for other people or how did that work?
Yeah, I actually did a lot of projects for that same company, Nino Cultural Consultants, for about 2 years. And I didn't have many other clients. I didn't really have any other clients. And but in 2020, as you know, everything changes. And I ended up needing to, archaeology had slowed down, or CRM, I should say, really slowed down in archaeology, or in Minnesota, excuse me. And I was realizing, you know, I'm having a tough time making ends meet right now, just doing this consulting business. So I started kind of keeping my eyes out to see what could I be doing, you know, to try and bring in more income, essentially. And at that same time, my my home community, the Red Cliff band of Lake Spirit Chippewa, or Ojibwe, I prefer, were looking for tribal monitors. And for those who aren't familiar on the show, describe what a tribal monitor does. So tribal monitoring is the monitoring of either construction or archaeological activities to see, if you're monitoring construction activities, it's often to see if there's any archaeological material there present that needs to be cared for. It's the construction or excavation, really, I should say, because it's mostly has to do with the digging. It's not like building a house. It's more like digging down for where you're going to like put a trench or something, like, or a utility or a road or something. Or often tribal monitors are monitoring archaeologists themselves to ensure that they are working in a way that is in compliance with or up to code with how the tribal community, the descendant community sees fit, to make sure that, that they say that they're going to do what they said they do in their proposal often the time. So I got a position doing tribal monitoring back home during 2020. And I did that for a while. And that was a great experience. I'm really, really grateful for it. And it was different in that I hadn't really done any monitoring before. And working for Red Cliff, this was the very first time that they had ever hired monitors. So myself and then another gentleman, we were the first two to do that. So that was like a very special thing to do. I was really happy and really honored to be part of that sort of endeavor. So that's that kind of led into that. I think that's where I got to see a little bit more. I had been thinking about and reading about and listening about Indigenous archaeology. And I had done a little bit of what we call like a tribal communications point person, because we had myself as a contractor with McCoon's Consulting and working with these other archaeologists, we had been monitored by tribal monitors in the past. And so I had worked with monitors and I was always sort of, you know, when I was working with these archaeologists, they're like, oh yes, you're the you're the indigenous one. Why don't you be the person that like makes sure that, you know, we call her and she knows where to go and that she knows how to find us when she gets on site and, you know, be the communications person. And I was like, well, sure. Yeah, I can do that. But it was, I think that was a good moment in speaking with some of those, with that monitor and some other monitors about like, okay, what are they doing? How are they doing it? Why are they doing it? What are they hoping to find or what are they hoping to not find or see? And learning a little bit more about it directly from them. And, you know, I was really curious more about this monitoring aspect. And I still am, you know, I think there is so much that monitoring could do for tribal communities here in the U.S. or, well, probably across the whole world. But I always kind of tend to think very much so about the U.S. and Canada because that's where I'm based. I think there's a lot to it. And that was sort of a big reason why I wanted to start the Tribal Archaeology Network, TAN. In that same summer that I was a tribal monitor for Red Cliff, I also started the Tribal Archaeology Network. And it kind of got born out of this thinking about being a tribal monitor and doing archaeology in my home community. And on top of that, I was getting to know more people in the archaeological community in Minnesota back home, where I should mention that Red Cliff's in Wisconsin. And so I was getting to know more people in this area and kind of asked to be doing different things for, you know, maybe a professional association, for an event, et cetera, involved with archaeology. And just thinking, you know, I wish I knew more indigenous archaeologists. That was kind of the moment I was like, God, like, I really wish I personally knew more indigenous archaeologists. Because at the time, I really only knew, or like the one I was in contact with was one of the other contract archaeologists that I work with. And so, you know, we'll chit-chat about, you know, she herself, she's not Ojibwe. And there's certain like cultural things and that I was like, man, I want to talk to someone who not only has like a traditional knowledge background about this, but like someone who also like really, I think, understands the nitty gritty of archaeology too, because it's such a unique, I think, space to inhabit as a person who is both an indigenous person and an archaeologist. So I was like, gosh, I want to talk to like my senior, like a senior indigenous archaeologist. I was like, I must find one. So I started the Tribal Archaeology Network, and I reached out to her as, and I did know a couple others, people kind of came out of the woodwork that I realized that I had met through the Council of Minnesota Archaeologists, one of them being Travis Armstrong, who is an Ojibwe archaeologist. And I had met him, maybe a couple of months prior through the Minnesota Archaeology. He had joined. He's from Minnesota. I believe he's enrolled in Leech Lake, if I'm correct. But he's done work in Minnesota. He got his PhD here, but he is based in California now. He was kind of my go-to. All right, I need a senior in indigenous archaeology, and I was talking to him. And I was talking to the TIPO for my tribe, Marvin Defoe. And I was kind of bouncing this idea. I was like, gosh, I kind of want to like start an organization where we can connect indigenous archaeologists and we can get these people to start having conversations, because selfishly, that's what I wanted. You know, I need that. I was like, I'm a baby archaeologist. You know, I still be like a baby archaeologist. And, you know, I need more big minds to learn from, people who know lots of things. You know, I need some elders who I can talk to, some elders of archaeology and elders of traditional knowledge as well. So that's where I started getting some people together and started having some Zoom meetings right at the height of Zoom in the summer of 2020 in the pandemic. And it worked out really well. I think people were just sufficiently bored enough at home from the pandemic and trying to also distract themselves from the chaos that was summer of 2020, that we had a pretty good interest of people, indigenous archaeologists. We had TIPOs. We had people in academia who all, some, I started sending out messages on like Facebook and having people send messages across like anthropology, archaeology listservs, email listservs for different institutions, et cetera. And we got this mix of people in academia. We had students, we had TIPOs, we had people in CRM come and join some of these Zoom meetings. And essentially, we were kind of meeting regularly. Now we're mostly on our email listserv. It's conversations going either on the email listserv, it's a lot of job postings, or there's a little more conversation that happens on Discord. We've actually moved into doing the Discord sort of stuff. And I think that was kind of the big brainchild at the time. I was like, we need a space for this, where people can sort of ask for guidance or ask for resources or talk about, you know, what they're doing or what they've done. If there's an interesting seminar, is there something going on? And having a space to share that where it felt like a safe space to do that, because it was directed towards archaeologists, CRM, tribal monitors, people who wanted to do Indigenous archaeology or were doing archaeology that they're working with Indigenous communities directly. So yeah, that was kind of the big brainchild of the big effort of 2020. Was trying to connect some of these people because I didn't want to feel alone.
Yeah. So if somebody's interested in being part of this listserv or the Discord group, how do they find out about it, or how do they get on it?
So our email listserv is hosted by Oregon State. And if I would actually recommend going to my business's website, which is makoonsconsulting.com. Makoons is MAKOONS and then consulting.com. And then there's a link at the top where if you click on the Tribal Archaeology Network, it will describe a little bit about what we do, what is our mission, our goals. Scroll down towards the bottom, there'll be a little sign up button, and that will bring you to that Oregon State email listserv subscription page. And they'll have directions on there, putting your email address and hitting the subscribe button. And we'll just put you right on there. And the Discord information is a little bit more complicated to get to, but I will probably send that. I think I need to start sending that a little more regularly over the email listserv, so people can get access to it. But there's a way to access it through a Google Drive, essentially.
Nice. Okay. And we'll put both your website for Makoons Consulting and the Tribal Archaeology Network page within your website in the show notes. So if anyone's interested in that, obviously you can search for it yourself as well, just from listening, you know, or you can go into the show notes and find the direct link if that's easier. So, okay. In 2020, you were tribal monitor. You started the Tribal Archaeology Network. And where have you been in the last 2 years?
Yeah, actually, I took a total left turn here. So doing all of this and realizing, you know, I'm doing archaeology and realizing I really see myself doing this for the rest of my life, I realized I really need a master's degree. So I ended up moving to the Southwest, actually for a number of personal reasons. My partner is from, yeah, my partner is from El Paso, Juarez, and we moved to El Paso in November of 2020 for some health reasons, and got him and also his mother, who was having some struggles. But as well, I had been searching for a master's program, and I was looking in Minnesota, and there's nothing necessarily wrong with the programs in Minnesota, but I really wanted something that felt very focused on cultural resource management, because I personally think that there's a lot of Indigenous archaeology, I think, has made a fair amount of headway in academia and academic circles. But I think that next hurdle is to really bring it to the forefront in CRM. And so I kind of see myself trying to help bridge some of that. So I was looking around at programs, and I was like, gosh, you know, I'm in the Southwest. This is where, you know, this is sort of the archaeology headquarters of the United States. I think a lot of archaeologists think of the Southwest for that, because there's just such excellent preservation as well as wonderful archaeology. So I started looking around, and just, you know, 35 minutes north of El Paso was Las Cruces. And New Mexico State University has a master's program that really appealed to me, particularly because you could get a certificate specifically in cultural resource management. And they had that track or certificate for, I think, since the 70s. It's a very long-standing program. And so I said, you know, if I want to be the queen of CRM, I might as well go to the place that's been doing the CRM degree for a long time. So I moved to El Paso, and then shortly thereafter, about 6 months after that, I moved to Las Cruces, New Mexico. And I've kind of been bouncing around on different projects there. I've been doing a little bit of work as an employee for a couple of different companies. And then, but I have still been doing work for McClinskin. So I served again as like a tribal communications point person for a couple of different projects that were Minnesota based, where I was spamming all the TIPOs in Minnesota to see if they were interested in sharing some information with us. And occasionally, you know, someone says, yeah, you know, I'll share some stuff with you. So I got to have some nice conversations that way. On a couple of different projects that I unfortunately can't really elaborate on too much just for privacy reasons, but that I found that really rewarding and very informative and interesting to do some of that. Yeah, I can't say that I'm a tribal liaison, because technically liaising between tribes is something that happens from federal agency to agency to agency, tribe, government to government. And we're working on a project that was I don't represent any government or agency as private. So, but I've been kind of bouncing around doing a little work in Minnesota as well as in Texas and New Mexico. So I've gotten some experience now in the desert, and it is a wild time in the Southwest. Let me tell you, it's very different.
Well, okay. I want to hear more when we get back about the difference, but right now we're already at our second break, so we'll just have to wait until we come back and hear more about the differences between the Southwest and Minnesota and Wisconsin. So with that, we'll be right back. Okay, and we are back. So I want to talk about differences between the Southwest and the Midwest, you know, New Mexico and Texas versus Minnesota and Wisconsin. But also, you mentioned earlier, your field schools and other work in Peru and Massachusetts. So, yeah, could you maybe touch a little bit on what it's been like working in all those different places, and what makes the Southwest so wild?
Sure. Let's see, my field school, I had two field schools, which is, I think, kind of unique. But my, my first field school was in Peru. It was through my college, and it was the San Jose de Moro Archaeological Field School in, what is the state now? Oh, it was in the Jequetepeque Valley. And a lot of people think of archaeology in Peru. They think of, the Andes and Machu Picchu and all that. And this was in the desert. It was in the northern desert of Peru. And I had a very lovely time. The sand there is so fine. I thought I had gotten like a really wonderful tan in my field school. And then we worked 6 days a week at our field school. And once I got back to the U.S., I took two consecutive showers, one day after the other, and my tan washed off. And I think all the sand just that was embedded in my skin disappeared. I was like, oh, man, I thought I had such a good tan. Not the case. Yeah, so that was a really interesting field school we were working. It was a Mote site. It was actually a burial site. And I think that was very, very different, because like here, I wouldn't want to do any burial sites. It's like, no, stay away. We don't want to do this. Please leave these people be. But in Peru, there's not really that stigma around it. And I kind of think about that a lot. I'm like, you know, but it's, we have such different concepts of of death and what it means to be resting. And didn't seem to be any qualms about it there. But that was a really interesting site, because it was among some huacas, which are like sacred sites, temporal sites. Huacas are like little pyramids. And then there was burials and other archaeological material nearby. And that's where a lot of our archaeological efforts were directed, as well as there is a archaeological site on top of a very nearby, like a little, I don't know if you'd call it a mountain range, actually, but you had to really hike up that one. that one was the difficult site to go to, but it was very interesting because there was definitely archaeological material up there, but it was so far away from any source of water or anything like that. You would have had to hike up a mountain essentially in order to live up there full time. And so it was kind of this little puzzle of like, oh gosh, like this really is a very practical place to be. But so I did my field school there in college. And then I think the really interesting field school that I did was actually right in Harvard Yard. So I went to Harvard College, and they have, I believe they are still doing it. They have what they call the Harvard Yard Archaeological Project. Harvard is been around for a long time. And so they just do archaeology right there in Harvard Yard. And I'm not quite sure where they've moved on to now, but when I was in school, they had been directing their efforts towards finding what is known as the Indian College. And the Indian College was the very first brick building in North America, actually, or no, at Harvard College, excuse me, the very first brick building in Harvard College. But it was also the location of the very first printing press in North America, which is pretty exciting. And not the year that I did it, but in previous years, they had actually been able to find print type for that had matched one of the very first books. Actually, I think it is the very first book that was ever printed in the United States. It's a Bible, but translated into the Wampanoag language. And they had found, I believe, an O from the typeset that had matched the set that was in that Bible. So from that book. So I thought that was really interesting. But so that was my other field school experience. And that was really, I think, that was kind of a formative understanding of Indigenous archaeology too, as well. Or just, I shouldn't say Indigenous archaeology, because there wasn't necessarily a lot of Indigenous people working on that project. I was one of them, but like I was a student. There was definitely like a lot of consultation from Indigenous communities on that project. And I think that was really interesting to see and learn more about. And, you know, like what were their concerns about that? And that same space where we had been doing archaeology, the Harvard was very insistent. The school itself was very insistent about like, you know, okay, you do archaeology here, but then you need to, you know, make sure you close up the hole. We can't have anyone wandering around the yard and falling in afterwards. So we had to be very diligent about making sure the lawn was manicured and put back in place so they could have, you know, good, nice green sod laid down for the students. But the interesting part was that space where we were digging was also used as a space for bringing attention to the Indian College. So there's a plaque nearby at Matthews Hall that talks a little bit about it. But there more so than the plaque. I remember while I was in college, we had a couple of events in that area during what we now call Indigenous Peoples Day. But when back when it was still called Columbus Day, we would hold a vigil there and sort of communicate why we didn't think that was, you know, appropriate to be celebrating him. And it was kind of used as that communal space of like bringing attention to Indigenous issues related to Harvard or just Indigenous issues in general, but like particularly being aware that, yes, we're on Wampanoag land and like we want to be acknowledging and respecting these people. And, you know, these are the people who had gone to the Indian school at Harvard and essentially didn't have a great time because most of them did not, actually none of them survived. The only one who actually managed to get a degree died shortly before he received it. It's rather tragic. And then it's kind of a tragedy that, yeah, it was essentially it was a school to proselytize to Indigenous communities. It was, you know, you were learning about, you know, being a Christian and that sort of stuff so that they could go back to their Indigenous communities and essentially help to convert them. So it's a very sensitive and subject, and it, you know, it's just very, you know, it was something that a lot of the descendant communities really wanted to be a part of in order to communicate, you know, what they felt about it and their interest in it, and like trying to communicate the nuance that comes with that as well of like, you know, these, you know, did they really want to do this or were they pressured into this? And, you know, what did it mean to, you know, be going into this outside of their home or outside of, well, it was their land, but outside of essentially the safety of their communities and moving into the white man's world at Harvard College in order to learn about it. Going back, I know you had asked me this earlier, but I was kind of starting to think really critically about like, okay, how do you do archaeology and honor all the different stories and perspectives that come with all these like really nuanced and difficult and sometimes really sad and tragic histories that come out of these archaeological sites and thinking about that really, really critically and really sensitively and like trying to include as many voices as you can in that conversation. Yeah.
You want to go back to grad school. And part of that is
yes.
basically wanting to do Indigenous archaeology within CRM, if I understood that correctly. So what are you hoping to do after grad school? Like, and how are you hoping to incorporate Indigenous archaeology?
Yeah. Well, for archaeologists, you need to be, if you really want to, you know, be the master of your own destiny in archaeology, you have to be able to be a principal investigator. And you need a master's degree to do that. And so that's kind of the big goal, is in order to really have control over projects that I take and the direction I want to go with them, as well as expand McCoon's Consulting to, you know, not just me doing field tech work and kind of doing these more peripheral things, but really taking like ownership of it. And it, you know, I'm the one that's applying for the grant, or I'm the one that's applying for this bid for this client, and trying to incorporate, more aspects of like Indigenous feedback or like descendant community feedback into a lot of these programs, into a lot of these projects. And I think, you know, I see myself with that, to being that principal investigator and expanding McCoon's Consulting that way. You know, I think it's a good way to do that. I think there's, yes, I started the Tribal Archaeology Network, and now I know a whole bunch more Indigenous archaeologists, but I want to know more. And in fact, I think it's time. I want to be able to start hiring some of these people and start training some of these people and, you know, getting more and more people into the field. And I think a lot of it is, you know, giving a chance to someone who, you know, has got a degree from a tribal college and doesn't maybe have a 4-year degree from somewhere else, and teaching them the skills of the trade and seeing if they like archaeology and seeing if, do you want to go further in this, and giving those people the opportunity to really feel confident in this field, because I think it is a really tough field to feel confident in as an Indigenous person. You're very often the only person in the room who's an Indigenous archaeologist. And if you're a brand new baby archaeologist and you're the only one, people still turn to you and say, well, what do you think about this? Oh gosh, I don't know, you know, like a lot of people are still sort of navigating that. And so to be able to make people feel, giving people that chance, I think in the door is a big, big part of what I really want to do. I think that's, just my passion project, I should say. So that's kind of where I see myself moving towards, is being able to not just educate people, but also with projects, start incorporating someone about, this project that we were going to do, because we aren't legally required to, but maybe we should, and maybe we should get some input on what they think, or, you know, maybe this client, we get some artifacts from this site, but legally the landowner, if you're doing a site on a private piece of property, any artifacts you find belong to the landowner. And very often we'll ask them, do you want to keep them? Do you want to donate them? Et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, starting to make it standard, you know, it's like, would you like to return this to a descendant community? Little things like that make a huge difference. And, you know, and start giving tribal communities and descendant communities sort of a little bit more ownership about the archaeology that goes on, and say, hey, we found these flakes, we found projectile points, we found ceramic. You know, do you have a safe place? Do you want to keep these so you can decide what to do with them? That's like these little things that I think I want to start making more. If I start doing it, you know, maybe that will become commonplace in the practice. Everyone else who's not an Indigenous owned CRM firm will say, oh, well, she's doing it. And like people, you know, the clients want that, or people see that and they say, wow, that looks, you know, we want to do that too. We want to incorporate that into the project, into our process. And so, you know, being that person who kind of helps to bring some of these ideas into the forefront is what I would like to do.
Yeah, that sounds amazing. Oh, and so along those lines, like, I mean, you just mentioned a couple of them, but like, what changes would you like to see in the field overall in the future? Like, what direction, like, what would you want CRM to look like in the future?
What do I want CRM to look like in the future? I think I want to see more Indigenous faces. I want to see TIPO offices, tribal historic preservation offices, expanded. You know, I think, and I think some of that is coming, at least I hope so, with a little bit more investment into, what is it, the with Deb Holland and the Department of the Interior, and kind of investing more into spaces, public lands. And there's going to be, I think, a future of more archaeology out there with more money theoretically going to these projects. And so I'd like to see more people working to incorporate and listen to Indigenous voices and Indigenous recommendations of like ways to do archaeology that, you know, subtle things like asking, like I mentioned before, you know, do you want to donate the land, you know, asking landowners, do you want to donate your artifacts to a descendant community? Or, you know, even seeing if descendant communities would be interested in that or not, because some might not have the capacity to do that. But I think starting to make people ask these questions and do these things is going to start putting things into motion, and more of the field, I think, is going to come. You know, I think there's more museums will open up, and more people are going to get interested in it, and more people are, there could be more tribal monitors. And at least that's what I hope for, is I, you know, if you start doing these sorts of things, tribes are going to start putting more bugs in people's ears in their home community. Like, we need more archaeologists, we need more archaeologists. And hopefully that will push people to get into the field more. So then I don't have to feel so lonely all the time.
Yeah. Well, okay. On that note, I guess, it's kind of an interesting note to end on.
Yeah. That was kind of bad, wasn't it?
Yeah,
that,
I know.
That last little sentence.
So yeah, more Indigenous archaeologists come into the field, so Anastasia doesn't feel lonely. Mm-hmm. And with that vision of the future.
Exactly. That's mostly why.
Yes. Well, I can't wait to, you know, have you on again in, you know, like 5 or 10 years and hear about how you're actually doing all of these really cool things. But in the meantime, thank you so much for coming on, and obviously all the best at NMSU.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to the Heritage Voices podcast. You can find show notes at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/heritagevoices. Please subscribe to the show on iTunes, Stitcher, or the Google Play Music Store. Also, please share with your friends or write us a review. Sharing and reviewing helps more people find the show and gets the perspectives of Heritage Voices' amazing guests out there into the world. Don't we just need more of that in anthropology and land management? If you have any more questions, comments, or show suggestions, please reach out to me at jessica@livingheritageanthropology.org. If you'd like to volunteer to be on the show as a guest or even a co-host, reach out to me as well, jessica@livingheritageanthropology.org. You can also follow more of what I'm doing on Facebook at Living Heritage Anthropology and the nonprofit Living Heritage Research Council, or on Twitter at Living Heritage A. As always, huge thank you to Lyle Belenqua and Jason Nez for their collaboration on our incredible logo.
This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV traveling the United States, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, DigTech LLC, Cultural Media, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Chris Webster.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.